Welcome to Controversy Hour on Catholic Answers. That's what I'm just calling that. That's like, I just thought of that. Oh, that'll, people will listen now if you call it Controversy Hour. Right, Nick? That was good. All right. It's not really Controversy Hour, though, so it's a little misleading. It's really just a Catholic discussion of the state of the world where I propose some news stories to our very well-prepared guests, and then they give me a Catholic perspective on those things, and I get to choose who the guests are, and I chose Carlo Broussard and Trent Horn today, and man, I did a good job. You can all, yes, it's okay. You can all say thank you to me. You're welcome, Nick. You're welcome about the great guests I got. Well, we lots of calls, so we're going to get to calls. You're welcome to call and participate, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. And the story we were talking about a bit before, in the Time Magazine cover story, yes, Time Magazine still exists. In the Time Magazine cover story on the space race, a slight moral objection raised, and you generally hear this a lot associated with the space race, I guess because it's so exorbitantly expensive and it's just so obvious, you know, like people are leaving the planet and that has the implication to it, I suppose, leaving other people behind or not being concerned about those who are poor. So the moral question about spending all this money, billions and billions and hundreds of billions of dollars, to get a few people to skip around on the moon or to maybe visit Mars and all that kind of thing, it seems in some ways to lack a proper sense of proportion given the fact that so many people are lacking even the basic necessities of life.
Well, let me take a crack at this.
All right, crack away, Trent Horn.
All right, let me spool a little bit here.
Spool.
Well, we look at what was the origin of the space race? The origin of the space race was the competition of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. That's why I did not enjoy that in the new movie about Neil Armstrong with Ryan Gosling, that, you know, they take out, you know, they don't show him putting the American flag on the moon. It's like, well, we did it for all humanity. No, we did it to show the Soviets that we are more technological prowess.
Plus, if I can just say, the flag looks awesome on the moon.
Well, yeah, there's no wind. It's just up there.
You got to show that. The American flag was made to be on the moon.
It looks great. Yeah. So the space race and the technology that was poured in the 1960s, by the end of this decade, we will have a man on the moon. I am Mayor Diamond Joe Quimby from Springfield.
That is a very good Ted Kennedy imitation.
So, right. So you might say that there's a roundabout way that this actually, that the massive amount of money in the 1960s that was poured into the space race is actually good for people who live in extreme poverty, in extreme circumstances. Because if you look at the history of the world, I'm finishing my book on socialism right now. In the Soviet Union, socialist communal food production policies led to famines that killed millions of people.
Yeah, some of that was intentional, though.
It wasn't.
Like, they wanted to kill Ukrainians.
Yeah, so they did.
I mean, when I say they, I mean Stalin.
Stalin did. That's called, the Ukrainians call it the Holodomor. Just like in Germany, there was the Holocaust, there's the Holodomor in Ukraine, is for that mass killing by starvation. So when you have the United States wanting to have expressed that it is a superpower that can compete with the Soviet Union, and that is a way to eventually help stamp out communism, which was and still remains today a source of human rights violations around the world, the money we spend into making sure that the United States and those who would defend freedom around the world have the ability to maintain authority and dominion over all aspects of the earth and even in space itself, to provide peaceful societies, peaceful environments for people, and, you know, to eventually help to expel this communist threat, actually has raised the standard of living. When you look at the history of the 20th century, societies that have retreated from communism experience leaps and bounds in human development, in improved standards of living, improved life expectancies, lower infant mortality. So to me, it's once again, everything we do, it has kind of a ripple effect amongst other human beings. And that includes the exploration and technological innovation that is achieved through space exploration.
Fair enough. And it is true that after 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism, humanity entered the greatest period of spreading of prosperity in the history of the world. It's I'll just tell you this little story. When I got out of college, I remember I went on a retreat and it was by a guy who was very concerned about the social situation of the world, and he did a very good job actually. Among the things he said was that 40,000 children, when I graduated from college, this is the early 1980s, or middle 1980s, 40,000 children a day were dying of hunger or a lack of clean water. 40,000 a day.
Right. Yeah.
Now, in the intervening years, the population of the Earth has grown by 3 billion people.
Yes.
And that the number of children who die each day now has not gone up. It has dropped by about 70%. So while we're adding 3 billion people to the planet, we're also creating enough wealth to feed billions and billions more people, save millions of lives. And I say this for two reasons. One, because the fall of communism really released enormous economic energies in the world, really saved millions and billions of lives. And two, people should stop with this overpopulation baloney. More people means more food, not less food. It's obvious if you just look at the statistics.
Yeah, and I think that it's important for us as Catholics, like I think we were talking during the break, that the question of should you help the poor is obvious. You have to. I think it was Archbishop Chaput who said that you'll go to hell if you don't help the poor, if you just abscond on that responsibility.
You know who else said that?
Jesus.
Go, Carlo. Yeah, you're right. Right, which is I am not sure how church structure works, but I think he's even higher than Archbishop Chaput.
Jesus?
Is,
yeah.
Is Jesus a Messiah or an arch Messiah? We have to catch in there. But right. So, but the question of how though, the question of how is where it becomes tricky.
Okay.
And so people can reasonably disagree. So we were talking earlier, like I was talking about how some ways of fighting poverty can actually be counterproductive. I want to be able to add to that, because some of them might think Trent is a heartless monster who doesn't think we should help the poor. No, we should just do it smartly. That's a word, I think. Yes,
yeah,
the adverb, to act in a smart way. For example, in my research, there's something called effective altruism. So effective altruism is taking our resources and using them most efficiently to help those who are in need. When you look at that, one of the most effective ways to help people, ways that I've enjoyed donating to in the past, for example, are by providing malaria nets to people in developing countries. It's a $3 net will save, $3 will save two lives through the use of these nets, for example. Very efficient way of saving lives. Another is simply to do direct cash transfers.
That give you people money.
Do an end run around NGOs, around corrupt governments, and get a direct cash transfer directly to the person who is in need. Another great way to do that is through something called microloans. So it's counterintuitive. You think we'll just give people money, but in many cases, you can go online, find a guy who says, I need $50 to buy goats for my goat farm, and you offer him a 0% loan.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he feels the duty to have to pay you back encourages him to spend the money wisely to build up his business, and then he pays you back and use the money to give somebody else a microloan.
Plus, I'll come get the goats. If I don't get my money, I'm coming to get
the
goats.
I will fly over to Mozambique and get my goat. But there, so it's about looking at ways. That's why I hate this idea that some people will say, oh, you don't believe in helping the poor. And I think sometimes what they mean is, well, you just don't support my program for helping the poor. No, we should be able to prudentially disagree to reason, to have a reasoned debate about the best ways to do that. We all agree we must. Now let's find the smartest ways to achieve the goal.
Again, 888-318-7884 is the number. Actually, Denise in Michigan called us on this very topic. We got you there with us, Denise?
I am. My call's a little bit late, but I was driving home. What I wanted to say was, didn't Mary, the Mother of God, identify herself as the Immaculate Conception?
Indeed, she did. Yes,
she. Oh, I hit the wrong button.
You
there.
Hit the wrong.
She did.
You meant to go to another caller, Cy, and that's quite all right.
No, I mean I hit the wrong button. I put Denise on hold there for a second. So, Denise, is that your question? Is about whether Mary is the Immaculate? Oh, because it has. So we were talking about
when
life begins.
When life begins.
Oh, okay. Is that the context you meant that?
Yes, I don't think that she did that without purpose.
No,
well, she
clearly
identified herself as immaculate at any stage of life or even prior to life, but she called herself the Immaculate Conception. I think that was with purpose.
Oh, sure. I would agree with that. Yeah. But she didn't reveal to us from God at exactly which moment
she was conceived.
Right. That, you know, it, precisely the empirical data of when you have the transition from a non-living being to a living being. That would have been helpful if she would have.
But this does give you a kind of a really kind of helpful convergence of faith and science.
That's
here.
Right. It does point to the importance of protecting the unborn and the importance of protecting human life. Indeed, that sure. testifies to it.
But
most
the church also wouldn't include this, for example, in a catechetical document or magisterial teaching necessarily, because this is an element of private revelation.
Right.
This is to what, Fatima, Bernadette?
Not at Fatima,
Our Lady
no.
of Bernadette's.
Our Lady of Lourdes.
Our Lady of Lourdes, yes. Yeah. What was her name, Bernadette Soubirous or...
I just know Song of Bernadette. That's yeah. I just know the movie.
So that was a private revelation, which one can accept and believe, but one is not obliged to believe because it's not a part of the depositive faith. So
but
if it's helpful to you, yeah.
but I
but
believe
what
it.
Is, but what is a part of the private? Excuse me. But what is a part of the deposit of faith is that Mary
was
is
immaculately conceived.
Immaculately
yes.
conceived.
Yes.
Subaru. Is that correct?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Subaris?
All right.
No?
Denise, I find that very helpful because as much as these two put caveats around it, I do believe that Mary appeared to Bernadette. I do believe right. that Mary identified herself as the Immaculate Conception. And I do feel a sense of encouragement from that, that, hey, you're on the right track when you're sure. protecting the unborn from that moment of conception.
And that's the point of private revelations that God gives us in our journey of faith in order to confirm the brethren, right? In order to yeah. confirm us in the faith, to help us grow in our faith, and to help us have a greater and deeper devotion to Our Lady in this particular case.
Denise, is that about what you wanted to say?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. It was really, really helpful. I appreciate it. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Well, we'll take more of your calls, actually, when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
There's so many things that are wonderful about gathering with Catholic family, to gather with Catholics in the present on earth, knowing that we're also gathering with Catholics from the past and in heaven, that consciousness of the communion of saints uniting heaven and earth.
Meet Dr. David Anders and other EWTN favorites when you attend the EWTN Family Celebration, Saturday, September 21st at Magnus Arena in Denver, Colorado. Register now and find out more at EWTN.com/Family Celebration.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm delighted that we went to Denise. That was a very helpful call, but it wasn't the call I meant to go to, which makes it confusing why I was saying she was right on topic. She was referring to an earlier topic, a topic about when does life begin. And we're talking a little bit now in light of the billions and hundreds of billions of dollars being sent to...
billions and billions of dollars.
To shoot rich people up to the moon.
Billions of dollars.
Now, was that Richard Nixon?
No, that was another prominent politician. Who likes to say, he says billionaires and billionaires.
Oh, that was Bernie. Yeah, Bernie.
When you're saying billions and Sanders, billions, yeah. I want to say billionaires and billionaires.
See, if when I was a kid, if you had said billions and billions, people would have thought of Carl Sagan. Who you say
the pale blue dot.
Billions. I can't do an imitation of Carl Sagan talking about stars and then trying to teach small children that there were so many stars that there couldn't possibly be a god. Don't tell me how Carl Sagan got to be an atheist because he saw so many stars, but he did. Let's go to Maggie in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus is one of my top 10 favorite Ohio cities. Maggie, your comment or question?
It is a fine city. Thanks for taking my call. So the conversation's been really interesting for me because I've been feeling morally convicted. Every day I drive to work and I get off the highway, there is always someone standing there with a sign that says they need cash. And every time I never stop, I never get out my wallet. I keep driving. But I always feel terrible about it. In fact, I sort of hope that they're not going to be there when I'm driving by so I don't have to face it.
Right.
But I've heard different things. I've heard, you know, at my church, which is in an urban area, they'll say, you know, don't give to the panhandlers, encourage them to come in to get a, you know, a sandwich at the soup kitchen. But then I've also heard people say, you know, maybe they're just going to use it for drugs you shouldn't give. But
right.
then, you know, should we be judging how people spend their money? It's just,
that's a tough one, huh? So you want to know, as a Catholic, what are your obligations and what should you be doing when someone's begging for money from you? Is that
the
correct?
Panhandling debate? Panhandling
yeah.
dilemma.
That's it, Maggie?
Yes, that's it.
Oh, yeah. I just want to make sure I got the question right. Either of you want to take this one?
Go ahead, Trent.
Sure.
Oh, good, because I wanted to.
Well, this goes
with you.
Back to that question that if someone is hungry, if someone is poor, we ought to help them. That's non-negotiable. The question of how we help them, though, is an issue that requires a prudential judgment. So we should not do things that we think are helping, but could enable someone to make a bad decision. So there's a great movie with Steve Carell, not Steve. Yeah, I think Steve Carell, A Beautiful Boy. And it's based on a memoir about a father whose son becomes a drug addict, and the son keeps asking, you know, for money from him. Dad, I just need a little more money, a little more money. And, you know, the son's, you know, he's down now. He's, you know, living in poverty, but the dad says, "I can't give you anymore because I know you're going to hurt yourself with this. I cannot do that." So in some cases, giving someone money, knowing if you have reasonable moral certainty they're going to hurt themselves with it, you can't do that. Now, the question becomes, with someone who is panhandling, we're not in a good position to know
right.
how the person will use the money. So this is my personal recommendations. One thing my wife and I like to do is we pass out gift cards for restaurants. So in some cases, if someone's like on an on-ramp.
After you use them, or these are ones that you haven't used yet?
Oh, we leave a little bit on the card for them. We leave 83
cents. I know Laura would give out money, but I just wasn't sure if you had already been to Olive Garden and now you're just
giving
out.
Well, honestly, the one I pick that's the easiest is McDonald's. Because
they're everywhere.
Because they're everywhere. It's easy for someone who is homeless, for example, or who, you know, panhandles to find a McDonald's to go and get at least some calories, get coffee, get something to eat, fill their belly. And it's actually economical. You know, you've got the dollar menu. You can actually get a $5 McDonald's gift card can actually go decently far. And I was not paid by Ronald McDonald to come on here and say that. You know, that's, or you could do something similar. We would also make homeless basket, like bags to give to people. And that way it lowers the probability, Maggie, that someone, you know, with cash, it's easy to spend on a vice that's not great for you. But with a gift card or a bag of things to supplies to help, you know, much more likely that will be used for a certain good. Though I think that a person who does not give to a panhandler is not doing anything morally wrong if they're choosing to help the poor in a different way, such as by giving to a soup kitchen, giving to Catholic charities, things like that.
Maggie, I want to get your response on that.
No, I think that's a great suggestion. I was talking to my husband about it, and we talked, you know, maybe we should be just giving more to a soup kitchen or something like that, and maybe I would feel better about it. But I like the gift card idea. Just kind of keep a stack of them in the car, $5 gift cards.
And it's great to do a gift card.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
A $5 gift card and a holy card. I think, you know, you give both, and you're witnessing to that person, because there's also, you might... There's still the fact of the matter is, even if we're donating to a charity, God brings people into our lives in various ways. And in these cases, you know, I pray, and sometimes I will give money because I just pray and I just feel moved by the Holy Spirit that it's going to good. And I can't always recommend it in every case. You're going to have to pray and say, God, what do you want me to do in this situation? But now that's in the off-ramp situation. In other situations where you're not in your car, sometimes what I will do is if someone is, hey, buddy, can I get some money or change? I'll say, well, I don't have any money. That's a mental reservation in that I don't have money for you to give to you right now.
Oh.
But what I do have is I could go inside and buy you something to eat if you'd like that.
I always find that one wonderful because then you spend a minute with the person too. Like,
you do.
Would you like to come in and I'll get you something?
But what is sad, and it requires prayer to not become cynical, I would say the majority of the time I am declined when I offer that.
Right.
And that shows that the problem we have in America when it comes to poverty and homelessness is not a problem of people not having access to resources. it's usually a problem of mental illness and drug addiction. We have to come up with better ways to protect people from the evils of drugs and to heal them from the physical evils involved in mental illness. And when we fail to do that, poverty naturally ensues.
I want to challenge both of you. While we got Maggie on the line, I want to challenge both you, Carlo and Trent, with a quote from Jesus himself. All right? It's in both Matthew and Luke's Gospels. I'm reading from Luke chapter 6. If someone strikes you on the cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone takes your cloak, do not withhold your tunic as well. Give to everyone who asks. And if anyone takes what is yours, do not demand it. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I'm particularly interested, of course, in the line that says, give to everyone who asks. It's really, Jesus is not putting a lot of qualifiers around that. So how do you address that?
Well, I mean, my first thought is that we do have to take principles of reason, which have been given to us by the same author of those inspired texts and the same words of Jesus himself, right? He's the author of reason. So he has given us principles of reason to use in order to evaluate his words, right? And to interpret scripture. So in an absolute way, anybody who asks, well, if that were the case, well, then we would have to follow that principle and say anybody who comes knocking on my door and saying, give me all of your money, I would have to give it to him. But that doesn't make sense, right? Because my money is ordered toward my children and my family. I couldn't just give them all of my money because then a great good would be lost, namely fulfilling my duty as a husband and as a father and taking care of my family. So that's a principle of reason that we could take to that passage in order to help us understand perhaps what Jesus is trying to get at there is that we need to have a generous attitude towards those who are coming to us in need. And if reason, if it's in accord with reason, and reason leads us and demands that there's a justice here, that we need to fulfill justice and help them in serving the poor, then we ought to do that. And how we do that, Trent gave some great examples there. And even if we're not demanded by justice to provide for this particular individual, well, then perhaps it is an opportunity to exercise great virtue and heroic love, right? Even if you're not obliged,
right?
It is an opportunity, as Trent said, being moved by the Spirit in this particular circumstance to perform an act of love for God and for the person. And of course, that's going to contribute to an increase in grace and sanctity and holiness.
Right.
So that's something else that we also have to take into account when trying to discern these situations.
And we have to remember when Jesus speaks, Jesus is a rabbi. Rabbis teach in hyperbole.
Right.
Say, well, Jesus says, give to everyone who asks, and whenever they ask, you're supposed to do it. Say, well, Jesus also says to cut off your hand and gouge your eye out. You know, he says—
No, he doesn't.
He does.
He says, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Your hand never causes you to sin. That's not possible. Only your will can cause you to sin. That's not just hyperbole. That's like almost a joke that he's making there.
The point he's making is that if something is what ends up leading unison, or the eye. I look upon things in a lustful way. I use my hand to do evil.
You have kung fu power. I mean, you can do a lot of evil with your hands.
These are deadly weapons here. If I accidentally kill you with them, I go to jail. If you accidentally kill me, you go to jail anyway. So the Tarantino movie that's out. But the point is that Jesus, he speaks in hyperbole. That's how rabbis have taught traditionally and how they still teach today. He says, be better to, the other rabbis of the time would say things like, it's better to throw yourself in a furnace than to do this evil thing.
Jesus said, call no man father, right?
Yeah. Right.
If you don't hate mother and father, you're not worthy of me. And I think in Luke 14:26, right?
But so Matthew, he's using these hyperboles to create a disposition.
Matthew explains the meaning of that, if we love mother and father more than Jesus.
Yeah. Right. So when Jesus says, give to those who ask, immediately after this says, do unto others you would have them do unto you. The point is, don't divide up people as saying, these are the people worthy of my help because they're friends or family or they're Jews.
Yeah.
Divide us so that even enemies, even those who are part of a race of people who have normally been antagonistic towards you, to recognize their common humanity.
And we have to have a charitable disposition towards them as well.
Yeah. Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you. Maggie, is it helpful to you?
Yes, extremely helpful. You, you may have solved my problem. Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it.
You're welcome very much, Maggie. Thank you. I don't think it's possible to solve Maggie's problem, though, because it's always going to, there's always going to be prudential judgments you have to make. You just have to accept, say, hey, sometimes I'm actually going to get this wrong. Jesus isn't saying, you got to get it right every time. And that guy was 90% more likely to have a drug addiction than that guy. You have to make decisions in the moment.
Right.
And you have to, as long as you're doing so with goodwill, I think you just have to accept it.
Yeah, sure. To act with goodwill in accordance with reason.
Yeah, right.
With the available facts that you have at your disposal.
And don't let yourself off too easy either. I mean, really, like you can't. Somebody needs you.
In Maggie's case, if she's feeling moved by the Spirit to help out, then help out in a reasonable way.
Fair enough. Okay. I really found that very helpful. Maybe, I don't know. 888-318-7884 is the number. A whole bunch more calls. Hope they're as good as Maggie's. If you're on the line, try to make them as good as Maggie's. All right. We'll be right to you right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Trent Horn. Did you know that you can have me and other Catholic Answers speakers headline your next conference or parish event? Go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com to get all the information you need to book one of our dynamic speakers today. That's CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
I'm Monsignor Charles Pope.
And I'm Deacon Harold. The Morning Glory team faces up to the Face app.
Monday morning, 7 Eastern. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
That's the groovy music right there. Carlo doesn't even know what that is because he hasn't been on the Thursday before. He's like, I don't know why Si's so happy, because every Thursday we used to play the groovy music.
I love groovy music.
And then Nick stopped playing the groovy music. And then a caller called yesterday and said, "Where's the groovy music?" And look at that. Nick brought it out again.
I did the dance I would call, if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube Live, I call that the Chuck E. Cheese. So it's just like rapidly moving your arms like a Chuck E. Cheese animatronic. Though nowadays kids don't know what that is. You'd have to call it the Five Nights at Freddy's, just like, you know,
yeah,
the animatronic.
I don't know if I would classify that as groovy.
Carly, you're going to get emails. You be careful, like, because the groovy music is very popular. You be careful right
groovy
now.
Groovy,
Carla Broussard,
is like funk type stuff. That's groovy.
Well,
like
the it's
music,
got a groove.
Like the music for the game show. I would classify that as groovy.
That is...
Listen, Carla Broussard, you should send him the emails that he has somehow insulted the sanctity of the groovy
music. No, I would
say music.
Funk is a subset of groovy, but the kind of groovy we were listening to is more like... Funk. It's like mid-1960s groovy. Late 60s groovy. You're thinking
which is
of more
exactly
like 70s
what I am. I'm mid-1960s
Grand
groovy.
Funk Railroad.
I was born in the mid-1960s, so I'm...
You're groovy.
I have that groovy, baby.
Now I'm thinking of Army of Darkness. Groovy, baby.
Groovy.
Oh, I was thinking of Austin Powers.
Groovy, baby.
Yeah.
I still prefer Ash from Army of Darkness.
I like Carlo, though, the musician. Getting it. I don't know if I would classify that as groovy. That falls into a... You'd need a little more funk to it. You need a little more...
Although my music education is quite a bit limited.
Is it really? You're like a great musician. I have heard you musicize.
Yeah, which... but I'm just a Southern boy, man. I'm trapped in the Southern boy music.
You're humble. That's humbleness.
I'm not like humility. Trent, who can do a podcast on classical music.
my top seven favorite pieces, if you're interested.
But anybody can do their top seven favorite pieces of classical music because
it's subjective.
Those are the ones that you know.
Okay, like, what are your seven favorite?
First, Celine Dion, when she sings that one from the boat movie. What's that?
My Heart Will Go On.
We're thinking something more like classical music, right?
Like Beethoven, Tchaikovsky.
Oh, Beethoven.
I'm willing to allow Wagner.
Okay. Well,
I like Wagner.
There's nothing that Tchaikovsky ever wrote that's bad. It's all good. Because he's like a melody man, and I like melodies. Tchaikovsky is a genius of melody. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at the ballets. It's like melody. It's like, this is the greatest melody ever, and then another greatest melody ever follows it. It's like listening to Paul McCartney.
I don't know if it's the greatest melody. It is great. It's probably he's probably the greatest Russian composer of all time, at least, I would say.
No, there's greater composers than Tchaikovsky. I'm just saying.
I'm talking about Russia.
He's just really good at...
He's great, absolutely.
Yeah, Rachmaninoff second. I would put that there. Okay. I love romantic Russian music. How you like this, Carlo? You didn't think I could talk it.
Talk it, brother.
Also, I'd have to put Nessun Dorma up there. That's one of the greats. Also, Enfant du Temple Saint, the wonderful...
Ooh, you said that very well.
Thank you very much. That's Bizet, I think, from the Pearl Fishers. Mm-hmm. You want to keep going? No.
No, we're at four. That suffices.
All right. John in... Oh, he's right here in Chula Vista, listening to EWTN, Channel 130, Sirius XM, satellite radio. You are up next, John. Your question or comment, you're free. It's free form, so whatever you got.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hi, John.
Hi. So... I have a question about something that I read in Guadiamet's... Well, actually, it's in Veritatis Splendor, quoting Guadiamet's Blessed. So St. Pope John Paul II was listing intrinsic evils.
Right.
And he lists among them deportation.
Right.
And that's kind of been an issue here in our country recently. It's resurfaced as an issue in our country recently. And I'm wondering in what context he's talking about that, because I believe that Guadiamet's Best was written at the end of towards the end of the Vatican Council.
It's right. One of the documents of the Second Vatican Council.
That's correct.
Right. It's but I think it was towards the end of it.
Okay.
But I just was wondering what the context was of including deportation in there, and how we apply that today.
Right. Actually, our colleague Jimmy Akin has a wonderful article on this called Is Deportation Intrinsically Evil? That you can see at Catholic Answers Magazine online. But when we look at this in paragraph 27 of Gaudium et Spes, it talks about these intrinsic evils that are offensive to human dignity, arbitrary imprisonment, deportation, slavery, prostitution, and trafficking in women and children. The Latin word used here is deportatio, which can mean... even, you know, deporting. It means the same thing as in English, to deport someone. But I think you're right that context is key here. So this was written back in 1965 when issues like illegal immigration, like we're talking now, we're debating the United States about deporting people who are unlawfully present in the United States, or people who are in the United States who did not go through the proper legal framework to attain either citizenship or permanent residency. And so they risk deportation under various circumstances. That was not debated as much, a worldwide debated issue in 1965. Really, the thing that was more a problem when you go back into the 1940s during World War II, you had cases of people who were seeking asylum from ethnic cleansing and genocide who were deported back to places like Nazi Germany, for example. And so I would say here that deportation of sending people either in one part of a country to another part to be exterminated or back to a place where they face a grave threat like ethnic cleansing is what falls under the status of deportation. It can't mean simply sending someone out of a country as part of a punishment, because even the Vatican itself reserves the right to do that. Jimmy notes in his article that the 1929 Lateran Pact that the Holy See has with Italy says that it will turn over criminals to Italy who are within the Vatican, within the Holy See, for extradition. So if you said all deportation is intrinsically evil, then if, you know, I murder somebody and I get to Canada, you say, well, you can't deport him back to the United States for trial. Like, if I kill Cy, I got it in. I got one in there. I got one in there within the context.
Now, Carlo doesn't know what you're talking about, but he kills me off a lot in his example.
I do kill you off a lot. So if deportation were wrong, then if I killed Cy and went to Canada, then it would be, that would mean the Canadian government couldn't send me back to the United States for trial, which seems absurd for extradition. So clearly it cannot mean sending someone, removing them from one country to another is always wrong. That just can't be the case. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's better.
Sure. Okay. All right. John, we got another John coming up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we can read it in harmony with what the Catechism states, and Jimmy also points this out in his article in paragraph 2241, that political authorities, for the sake of the common good for which they are responsible, may make the exercise of the right to immigrate subject to various juridical conditions, especially with regard to the immigrant's duties toward their country of adoption. So what Jimmy's pointing out is that we have to read what the Vatican Council says in light of the historical context, in light of harmony with other teachings of the church, and then come to the conclusion that naturally what Gaudium et Spes was referring to was condemning, you know, mass ethnic cleansing type deportations, similar to what was happening in World War II.
Do you see how Carlo can answer a question about morals without killing me? Do you see how that he didn't mention me? He didn't kill me.
But my example will really stick with people.
That indeed it will.
It will stick with me. We got another John. Thank you very much, John, number one. John, number two, is in Seattle listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. John, your question or comment?
Yeah, my question is, the Catholic Church permits an evolutionary worldview. So how would they explain why God would create a world with death and disease before humans were on Earth and committed any sin?
Okay, I got to say something before I let Carlo answer. But so the Catholic Church allows you to hold evolutionary theory. The question is, and then why does God allow the world to be so full of death and sin? Why did he make the world that way? Just a quick tip for anybody who is interested in that question, because it's probably like a billion people. Carlo just finished a fantastic series of focus episodes for us, three of them in a row, on evolutionary theory and God's existence. It's about why evolution doesn't eliminate God. I realize it's slightly different than the question that you're asking, but it's well worth listening to. The first one is up right now at Catholic Answers Focus. The next two will be over the next 2 weeks. If you haven't listened to Catholic Answers Focus, Carlo is the guy to start with. You will not be sorry about the content that you get. So head over to Catholic Answers Focus and grab that one that's already out, and then wait next 2 weeks. Over the next two Wednesdays, the next two will be out. Okay, Carlos. So the question, you are permitted, first of all, he's correct. As a Catholic, correct, you are permitted to accept the theory of evolution or any theory of evolution. Right. Yeah.
Well, my first thought, John, is that it coheres and is consistent with God from a philosophical perspective and willing to create a material world. Inasmuch as he wills to create a material world and boring a perpetual miracle, you're going to have generation and corruption, where the good thing of the flourishing of one thing is going to curtail the flourishing of another. That's just simply part and parcel of a material world with material beings. Things come into existence, they go out of existence. And even the Catechism hints at this in paragraph 310, where it's asking the question, why did God not create a world so perfect that no evil could exist in it? God has infinite power. He could have created such a world and performed a perpetual miracle to stop material beings from corrupting and going out of existence and dying, etc. But in his infinite wisdom, he willed not to do that. Aquinas has some principles in his writings that I think shed light upon that the inferior can be sacrificed for the superior, for the good of the whole of the universe. is one principle in Aquinas' writings that sheds light on that. But the Catechism recognizes that, you know, even prior to the fall, that God created the world in what it calls a state of journeying towards its ultimate perfection, where things come into being and go out of a being. So the Catechism is recognizing that things come and go. There's death, right? There's generation, there's corruption, even before the fall, and that God in his infinite wisdom willed to create the world in this state of journeying towards its ultimate perfection. So philosophically, it's consistent in that God will to have a material world with material things, and he can order the death of those material things to a greater good and the good of the whole. Now, when it comes to human beings, the Catechism points out in the surrounding paragraphs that when it comes to human beings, God had willed, on condition that Adam and Eve did not sin, that Adam and Eve, as well as their descendants, would not experience suffering and death had they remained in divine intimacy, that God would have performed a perpetual miracle to preserve human beings from suffering and dying. But because they forfeited that gift due to their disobedience, that death entered into human history. So those are a few thoughts that I would share with you, John, in order to try to contextualize this and to show that death within the material world, even prior to the fall of Adam and Eve, is consistent with our understanding of God as the creator of all things.
John? John, is
okay,
that?
Thank you.
Oh, okay. All right, very good. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Carlo and Trent right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's street evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Basically, the Friday panel shows are just for me. I get to talk to people I really like talking to, really smart people about stuff that I want to talk about. But lots of callers today with questions and things they'd like to discuss, and we welcome that. 888-318-7884, the number. I still have some news stories I want to get to before the end, but I want to get to these callers if I can, just to be fair to everybody. So let's go to Donna in Tahoe. We didn't have something else we had to wrap up. I'm not forgetting something, right?
No, we're good. So.
Okay. Sorry. A little brain cramp there for a second, Donna. Hi, Donna. Your question or comment?
Hi, Si. How are you?
Oh, this is our good friend Donna who comes to the conference every year. Will we be seeing you this year, September 26th through 29th?
I will be there.
All right.
And I will be there to see you and see everyone.
I recognize your voice. And Donna also comes in the day before the conference usually. And
I do.
And you usually say something into the microphone for us.
Yes, I will be there, too, to visit y'all and to say whatever it is that I need to say online,
well,
which will be fun.
Well, it's nice to have you with us today, Donna. What was the comment or question that you had?
Well, the thing that I wanted to say was, you know, when it comes to giving to the poor, I think a lot of Catholics, when we go to Mass on Sunday and we give for the first collection, that is our giving. And I think a lot of Catholics feel guilty when we don't give to the second collection or when we're out driving around and we see, you know, people, you know, asking for money.
Mm-hmm.
I think Catholics need to understand that when we go to Mass and we give in that first collection, we are giving to the poor. And it's up to the Catholic Church. We trust the Catholic Church to do with that money what's needed for the poor. And that's what I needed. That's what I needed to say.
All right, let's let Carlo and Trent address that. But I just want to get something clear. So you're saying that if there's a second collection, don't give to the second collection. You just want to give to the first collection.
I think she's saying not to feel bad if you don't.
Oh, okay.
Not necessarily don't give, but I'll let Donna.
Donna?
Guilted into giving to that second collection.
Oh, okay. Okay. I got you.
Yeah, I think Donna's on the right track here, that it is reasonable and morally permissible to trust. It's morally good to trust, not just permissible, but good to trust the church in using the funds as the church sees fit to serve the poor. But then there's also a question of, too, you know, of, you know, given those collections, you know, which collection goes to sort of church support, and then if there's a distinct separate collection or whatever, or a fund that would go specifically to serving the poor. You know, so we would also have to inquire about that. You know, are my funds just a general fund that the church can use to support the poor, or is it a fund that's going to be only to maintain the church and do church activities, and then a separate fund for serving the poor? So you would have to just simply inquire about that. But if it is just a general fund and the church is going to use these funds and use it to serve the poor, then yes, I mean, you would be contributing to serving the poor and thus meeting your moral obligation.
But I think also we have to, and you should probably inquire with your pastor about and ask for a copy of the church's financial records to show how weekly collections, what the church's budget is and how it's distributed. But I believe that the weekly collection goes primarily towards the upkeep and the maintenance of the facilities and paying the staff and salary of those who serve at the parish. And then a portion of it goes to the diocese itself. And the diocese can use that for a variety of different programs that help people and provide for all different kinds of corporal works of mercy, whether it's feeding the hungry, providing for those who are prison ministries, education. You'll have to look and see if we're obligated to help the church. I guess it's kind of the unofficial sixth precept of the church. If you look in paragraph 2043 of the Catechism, it says the faithful also have the duty of providing for the material needs of the church, each according to his ability. We need to provide for the church so we can have a place to worship God and celebrate the sacraments. But also, I do think that we should pray and discern and see the importance of also using what God has blessed us in ways that may be more directly focused on helping the poor. And the church provides us with those opportunities. That doesn't mean you should feel like you've got some kind of liturgical gun to your head to give to every second collection. But you should pray and say, well, is this specific need, whether it's for retired clergy or whether it's for missions work or whatever it may be, there is a difference between collections that are focused on a particular need and those that generally help the church's mission. And I think we have a responsibility to discern that.
When you talk about, a lot of people don't know about the diocesan tax, and it is important to the diocesan tax is very important because lots of really good things are done at the diocesan level.
That's
most parishes don't have a prison outreach, but the diocese will have an organized prison outreach, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But often the second collection is an untaxed collection. So if it says this is a collection for St. Vincent de Paul, the diocese is not taking part of that collection. It's going all to St. Vincent de Paul. So I don't know if everybody knows that, but it's something to consider in your giving as well. Does that address your concerns, Donna?
It does. It absolutely does. And I love you guys so much. And I can't wait to see you guys in September. It's going to be so much fun.
Did you know that?
God bless you all.
Did you know they're making me into a cookie?
I think they're making cookie.
I think I like the cookie better than the M&M. I'm sorry, Jimmy. I'm sorry.
No, objectively speaking, cookies are better than M&Ms. Cookies are the best.
If you look on Facebook,
I believe that's in the Bible. Cookies are the best food. So
that's second hesitations 3-4. The cookie, it kind of looks like you. It sort of looks like a logo we would put on it does. The printout looks like you. I've seen the actual cookie though.
You've seen the cookie?
I have seen the cookie. It looks like a logo you would put on. I'm pretty sure it's the real cookie.
No,
I've seen the cookie.
No, that's a sample cookie.
But it's a real cookie.
Yo, it's an actual cookie, but it's not. They didn't print me on it. And I just want to make clear.
Oh, is that not you? Because it looked like a refrigerator salesman.
No, that was a refrigerator.
Like a vacuum cleaner repairman.
Well, I don't know what a vacuum cleaner repairman
like
looks like.
Man. I don't know.
No, those were sample cookies. And I want to stress
exactly.
something.
This doesn't look like Cy at all.
No, because that wasn't like me. But I just want to stress something. Like, I feel like I have a really big head about the fact that I'm getting made into a cookie. I was just the last choice. Like, there are other people in the building refused to be made into a cookie. So I just want to make it clear that I'm not so special that they made me into a cookie. It was just they were like, who'll do it? And then they got to me, and I agreed to do it. Another caller on the line. Donna, thanks very, very much. Do we have another? Oh, no, it was a story I wanted to share with you. There were these three kids. Did you see this? It became viral. In a good way. Mm-hmm. These three kids in Canada, and they were going to Tim Hortons. It was kind of the middle of the night.
For those of you who don't know, Tim Hortons is a glorified Dunkin' Donuts.
No, Tim Hortons is Tim Hortons, which is the greatest donut chain in Canada. Right. We don't have to compare it to Dunkin' Donuts.
Because when I went to Canada, they said, you got to go to Tim Hortons. And I was like, this is a Dunkin' Donuts. But anywho,
go ahead. Canadian Dunkin' Donuts.
Oh, so it's just
Tim Hortons.
It's just really polite Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay, so these.
And speaking of polite.
Yeah, okay, so these three Canadian youths, they're driving in their car on their way out to get some Tim Hortons. And it's nighttime. It's like 10 at night. And they see a woman on the side of the road and her car is not working. And these three, they pull over and they just, they don't think this is a good place to leave this woman or anything. They're just good young Canadian fellers. And they push the woman's car.
Wow.
All the way home. 4 miles.
It says here they pushed it 7 kilometers.
Which is like 4 miles. Well, they don't have miles in Canada. People in Canada don't know what a mile is. So yeah, they went 7 kilometers.
7 kilometers, yes.
7 kilometers, they got back to their own car at 4:30 in the morning. I'm assuming they called their mom and dad about this. But I just wanted to end on a good news story.
There's still good people out there you can count on, at least in Canada.
No, there's good people everywhere. There's good people. That would happen in most countries. Maybe not. I don't know.
I wonder about the lady, what was racing through her mind when she saw three guys pulling up on the side of the road and then being relieved to know that these three guys were good guys.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Right, because it's a dark road at night.
Yeah, that must have been quite an emotional roller coaster.
It's good to hear stories like this, because with most news is if it bleeds, it leads. And so, for example, a lot of people think that, you know, crime has risen over the past 20 or 30 years when actually it's at historic lows. It's just the problem, we have a 24-hour news cycle, they got to fill it with stuff, and nobody wants to read or hear about just nice news stories that are like geopolitics all around the world. We want sensational stuff because it leads. But then that gives us a skewed understanding of reality.
Right. That's actually true. The news, if you watch the news every night, you're not more in contact with reality. You're less in contact with reality. You got to be really careful about that.
Because it's not news. It's just the things that sell.
But I want to ask you this.
There's a philosophical principle there, because evil is the privation of do good.
They find ways to fill the news cycle with a lot of privations.
There's a lack of being. Okay, but what do you call a person who stops at the side of the road and helps another person?
Good Samaritan, right?
That's what I thought. You call that person a good Samaritan. But in all the news reports, nobody called these kids good Samaritans. So I had to take something negative out of something good. I think our society is losing contact with these basic biblical references, or we just have secular references. We don't have, like, for most of the last 2,000 years, somebody stops on the side of the road and helps someone, you'd say, that's a real good Samaritan. And I didn't see the words good Samaritan anywhere.
Yeah, I guess, what do they come with nowadays? He's a stand-up guy.
Yeah, they said these are good kids and their parents should be proud of them. And they are. They're good kids that their parents should be proud of. But
How about that, Cy?
How about it?
How about this story?
Okay, so I want to just say, Carlo insulted the groovy music, and Trent insulted Tim Hortons. Send them the emails. I don't want to see the emails. Trent Horn, the author of many things, including most recently a book called Counterfeit Christ. You should get that book. It's really good, particularly the one on Che Guevara. But also, he's the proprietor of the podcast, Council of Trent. Yes. You can find that at TrentHornPodcast.com. Did I get that all right?
That is correct.
Thank you very much, Trent Horn.
Glad to be here.
Carla Broussard is the author of Prepare the Way, Overcoming Obstacles to God, the Gospel, and the Church. And you can find him at Catholic.com. Right, Carlo?
Yes, sir.
Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. You know it's true. And we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.